And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is a Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, June 17th, 168th day of the year. 197 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in history, in 653, Pope Martin I is arrested and taken to Constantinople due to his opposition to monotheism. 1242, following the disputation of Paris, 24 carriage loads of Jewish religious manuscripts are burned in Paris. 1397, the Kalmar Union is formed under the rule of Margaret I of Denmark. Now, the Kalmar Union was a personal union in Scandinavia, agreed to at Kalmar in Sweden, joined from 1397 to 1523, they joined under a single monarch the three kingdoms of Denmark, Sweden, which included most of present-day Finland and Norway, together with all the Norway's overseas colonies that included Iceland, Greenland, the Faroe Islands, and the northern islands of Orkney and Shetland. Now, the union wasn't continuous. There were several interruptions. Legally, the countries remained separate sovereign states, but their domestic and foreign policies were directed by a common monarch. Gustav Vasa's election as King of Sweden in 1523 and his triumphant entry into Stockholm 11 days later marked Sweden's final secession from the Kalmar Union. Formally, the Danish king acknowledged Sweden's independence in 1524 at the Treaty of Malmö. So there was a lot of machinations going on. 1462, Vlad III the Impaler attempts to assassinate Mehmed II, the night attack of Dragovisti, forcing him to retreat from Wallachia. Vlad the Impaler was the entity who became known as Dracula. He liked to impale his enemies on spikes. In 1497, Battle of Deptford Bridge, forces under King Henry VII defeat troops led by Michael Angoff. 1565, Matsunaga Ishihide assassinates the 13th Ashikaga shogun, Ashikaga Yoshiteru. 1597, Sir Francis Drake claims a land he calls Nova Albion for England. That was modern, what we know as California. 1596, the Dutch explorer Wilhelm Brandt discovers the Arctic archipelago of Spitsbergen. 1631, Mumtaz Mahal dies during childbirth. Her husband, Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan I, has spent the next 17 years building her mausoleum. We know it as the Taj Mahal. 1665, the Battle of Montes Claros. Portugal definitively secured independence from Spain in the last battle of the Portuguese Restoration War. 1673, French explorers Jacques Marquette and Louis Jouvet leads the Mississippi River and become the first Europeans to make a detailed account of its course. 1767, Samuel Wallace, a British sea captain, sights Tahiti and is considered the first European to reach the island. And he still couldn't get a room to stay at the hotel. 1773, Cucuta, Colombia is founded by Juan Rangel de Cayar. 1775, American Revolutionary War. Colonists inflict heavy casualties on British forces by losing the Battle of Bunker Hill. 1789, in France, the Third Estate declares itself the National Assembly. 1794, foundation of Anglo-Corsican Kingdom. 1795, the burghers of Swellendam expel the Dutch East India Company magistrate and declare itself a republic. 1839, in the Kingdom of Hawaii, Kamehameha III issues the Edict of Toleration that gives Roman Catholics the freedom to worship in the Hawaiian Islands. The Hawaii Catholic Church and the Cathedral of Our Lady of Peace are established as a result. 1843, the Wairau Affray, the first serious clash of arms between the Maori and the British settlers in the New Zealand Wars takes place on this date. 1861, American Civil War, Battle of Vienna, Virginia. 1863, American Civil War, Battle of Aldie and the Gettysburg Campaign. 1876, American Indian Wars, Battle of the Rosebud. 1500, Sioux and Cheyenne, led by Crazy Horse, beat back George Crook's forces at the Rosebud Creek in Montana Territory. He was on the way to relieve or to join up with Custer. Didn't quite make it. 1877, American Indian Wars, Battle of White Bird Canyon. The Nez Perce defeat the cavalry at White Bird Canyon in Idaho Territory. 1885, Statue of Liberty arrives in New York Harbor. 1898, United States Navy Hospital Corps is established. 1900, the Boxer Rebellion. Western Allied and Japanese forces captured the Taku forts in Tianjin, China. 1901, the College Board introduces its first standardized test. That's the forerunner of the dreaded SAT test. 1910, Ariel Villacou plots and A. Villacou on its first flight. Pilots, I should say, not plots, pilots. 1922, Portuguese naval aviators Gago Coutinho and Sacadura Cabral complete the first ever crossing of the South Atlantic. 1929, the town of Murchison, New Zealand is rocked by a 7.8 magnitude earthquake, killed 17. At the time, it was New Zealand's worst national disaster. 1930, President Hoover signs the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act into law. 1932, the Bonus Army, about 1,000 World War I veterans amassed at the U.S. Capitol as the U.S. Senate considers a bill that will give them certain benefits. 1933, that is also the period of time when a move was afoot for a coup to be led by a Marine general instead of putting the coup into effect. He ratted out the people behind it, but they were too politically prominent for anything to be done to them. 1933, Union Station Massacre. Kansas City, Missouri, four FBI agents and captured fugitive Frank Nash are gunned down by gangsters attempting to free Nash. 1939, the last public guillotining in France. Eugene Weidman, a convicted murderer, is executed at Versailles outside the St. Pierre prison. 1940, World War II, RMS Lancastre is attacked and sunk by the Luftwaffe near Saint-Nazaire in France. At least 3,000 are killed in Britain's worst maritime disaster. 1940, World War II, the British Army's 11th Hussars assault and take Fort Capuzzo in Libya, Africa from Italian forces. 1940, the three Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania fall under the occupation of the Soviet Union. 1944, Iceland declares independence from Denmark and becomes a republic. 1948, United Airlines Flight 624, Douglas DC-6, crashes near Mount Carmel, Pennsylvania. All 43 people on board are killed. 1952, Guatemala passes Decree 900. That orders the redistribution of uncultivated land. 1953, during the Cold War, East Germany workers' uprising. In East Germany, the Soviet Union orders a division of troops into East Berlin to quell a rebellion. 1958, the Iron Workers' Memorial, Second Narrows Crossing. In the process of being built to connect Vancouver and North Vancouver in Canada, the structure collapses into the Burrard Inlet, kills 18 iron workers, and injures a number of others. 1960, the Nez Perce tribes awarded $4 million for 7 million acres of land, undervalued at 4 cents an acre in the 1863 treaty. 1963, the United States Supreme Court rules 8-1 in Abington School District versus Shemp against requiring the reciting of Bible verses in the Lord's Prayer in public schools. 1963, a day after South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem announces the joint communique to end the Buddhist crisis, A riot involving about 2,000 people breaks out. One person is killed. At least that's what was officially reported. 1967, nuclear weapons testing. China announces a successful test of its first thermonuclear weapon. 1972, Watergate scandal. Five White House operatives are arrested for burgling the offices of the Democratic National Committee during an attempt by members of the administration of President Nixon to illegally wiretap the political opposition as part of a broader campaign to subvert the democratic process. 1985, Space Shuttle Program, STS-51G. Space Shuttle Discovery launches, carrying Sultan bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, first Arab and first Muslim in space, as a payload specialist. I can't talk. 1987, with the death of the last individual of the species, the dusky seaside sparrow becomes extinct. 1991, apartheid. South African Parliament repeals the Population Registration Act, required racial classification of all South Africans at birth. 1992, a joint understanding agreement on arms reduction signed by President George Bush and President Boris Yeltsin that was codified as START II. 1994, following a televised low-speed highway chase, O.J. Simpson is arrested for the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. 2015, nine people are killed in a mass shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And in 2017, a series of wildfires in central Portugal kills at least 64 and injures over 200 others. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many to go into. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Albert Chmielowski, Latof in England and Scandinavia. Gundolphus of Berry, Hervé, and Patheus of Bithynia in the Eastern Orthodox and Byzantine Catholic churches. Renarius, Samuel and Henrietta Barnett, a Church of England. Father's Day in El Salvador and Guatemala. Icelandic National Day celebrates independence of Iceland from the Kingdom of Denmark in 1944. Occupation of the Latvian Republic Day in Latvia. Remembrance of the East German Uprising in 1953. Now, that's a public holiday in West Germany between 1954 and 1990. Today, it's German Unity Day, and it's a public holiday. World Day to Combat Desertification and Drought. I'm sorry, Desertification and Drought internationally. And Zimla Intifada Day in the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic. My goodness, some of these names. Okay, in 653, Saint Martin I ends his reign as Catholic Pope. 656, Ali ibn Abu Talib is elected the fourth caliph of the Rashidun Caliphate. 676, Pope Adeodatus II's reign ends with his death. 1091, Floris II Devete becomes the Earl of Haarland. 1119, Charles the Good becomes the Earl of Flanders. 1535, English Catholic Cardinal John Fisher state rights. 1579 is an anti-English uprising in Ireland. 1580, Battle of Hardenberg, Spanish troops beat the rebels. 1583, Brabant, the Duke of Parma beats French mercenaries. 1665, Battle of Viciosa, English and Portuguese army beat Spain. 1700, Massachusetts orders a priest to leave the colony. 1734, French troops occupy Philippsburg and Rhine. 1788, after a lengthy stay in Europe, future President John Adams and his wife Abigail Adams come back to Boston on this date. 1815, Stephen Decatur conquers the Algerian frigate Machuta. On this day in 1824, the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs is established. 1837, Charles Goodyear gets his first rubber patent on this date. 1850, the paddle wheeler G.P. Griffith burns off Mentor, Ohio. 206 people die in the fire. 1855, heavy French and British bombing of Sebastopol and the Crimea. Over 2,000 are killed. 1861, Battle of Boonsville, Michigan. Brigadier General Lyon defeats Confederate forces. 1863, there's a naval engagement at Warsaw Sound in Georgia. The USS Weehawken versus the CSS Atlanta. 1863, Travelers Insurance Company of Hartford is chartered. It's the first accident insurance company. 1864, a 640-meter long pontoon bridge over the James River in Virginia is finished. 1864, Confederate General John Bell Hood replaces General Johnston as head of the Army of the Tennessee. And ultimately, Hood's army is destroyed. 1894, the first U.S. poliomyelitis epidemic breaks out in Rutland, Vermont. 1897, William Frank Powell, a New Jersey educator, is named minister to Haiti. 1902, Congress passes the New Lands Reclamation Act. It establishes a fund from the sale of public lands to build irrigation dams for the arid western lands. 1915, the League to Enforce Peace is organized at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. William Howard Taft, who became the 27th president, is president of the League. Its program anticipates the League of Nations. 1916, U.S. troops under General Pershing march into Mexico on this date. 1919, the Barney Google cartoon strip by Billy DeBeck premieres on this date. 1928, Amelia Earhart leaves Newfoundland to become the first woman passenger to fly the Atlantic. She's a passenger in a plane piloted by Wilmer Stultz. 1932, the oil tanker Cymbeline explodes in Montreal, Canada. 1938, Japan declares war on China. 1940, France asked Germany for terms of surrender in World War II. Also in 1940, General de Gaulle departs Bordeaux for London. 1940, German occupiers ration bread in Holland. 1944, French troops under La Trade de Tassigny conquer Elba. 1944, resistance fighter and poet Colonel Blake arrives in London. 1946, Southwest Bell inaugurates mobile telephone commercial service in St. Louis. 1947, Pan Am Airways is chartered as the first worldwide passenger airline. 1950, we have the first kidney transplant in Chicago. 1954, the CIA Exile Army lands in Guatemala. It's organized by John Foster Dulles and United Fruit Company. 1956, Golda Meir begins her term as Israel's foreign minister. She became the fourth prime minister of Israel. 1956, the Philadelphia experiment and the Brookhaven National Laboratory and some of the shenanigans that have gone on there. You know, there's been a lot of new information come to light on a number of these issues. Even the Kennedy assassination, new materials come to light. Let's talk about Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which is involved in the Montauk Project. Now, throughout the discussion of Montauk, there's been discussion of the Airborne Instruments Laboratory. With some of the folks coming from or going to the Montauk Project, the question becomes, is this a real company? Now, very few are aware about the role the Airborne Instruments Laboratory played during the preparation and conduct of the Montauk Project, maybe even during the time of the Philadelphia experiment. Now, the forerunner of what's known as AIL was a group of scientists working under the same name for the NDRC at Harvard that developed radar systems and radar countermeasures. And soon after the end of the war, the NDRC lab was closed and most of the scientists became the backbone of what was then a civil company, or civilian company, I guess you should say. In September 1945, Airborne Instruments Laboratory was established in Mineola, New York, by a group of scientists who were employed up to then at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory of the U.S. government. Some of the better-known scientists who worked there were Preston Nichols and Bob Dratch, who both claimed to have seen strange documents or have experienced odd events. I'm not sure what the issue is. As I say, in 2000, AIL merged with EDL Systems and ceased operations as an independent company. And from their own publications, you can see that AIL looks back on more than 50 years of experience in developing radar systems and related equipment. So this makes AIL the perfect candidate for the preparation and conduct of both the Philadelphia experiment and the Montauk Project. One of the names you always come across when you look at all this is Preston Nichols, who stated that he once worked for AIL. Marshall Barnes proved already that Nichols indeed had worked for AIL. Now, Barnes wrote a book called The Reinhardt Files. He described how he made a phone call to the Office of Human Resources, AIL, and he got the employment of Nichols confirmed. And there's some interesting facts that came to light. Now, AIL was working for the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Now, that was an arm of the federal government. They're working on electronic warfare, which included radar research, and, of course, on countermeasures that the Navy wanted to use. So all these circumstances make the first AIL a perfect candidate for the development of the Philadelphia experiment and The second AIL would be a good candidate for following experiments, including Montauk Project, as well as a... And a lot of the scientific personnel are identical between the two companies. Now, according to a lot of those who investigated the numerous projects, programs, and such things related to Montauk, there does exist some sort of international worldwide super government hidden behind the scenes of the world stage, so to speak. And they've been pulling the strings that have a substantial impact on the outcome of a lot of world events. Events often instigated and manipulated by these very same people. Now, very little, if anything, that might have any significant effect on the human race socially, politically, economically, even spiritually, just happens unless this hidden group wants it to happen, or at least allows it to happen. And such a phenomenon as the Third Reich would most definitely fall within that category. Now, not only did many prominent people openly support Hitler and some of the stated objectives of the Nazi movement before the beginning of World War II in Europe, but after the war, untold thousands of high-level Nazi Party members, top scientists, and intelligence officers came to the U.S. and worked for the U.S. government, and not just in the aerospace fields, as is commonly thought. In fact, our intelligence service received the biggest infusion of all. They incorporated a great many former Nazi agents and many of the Nazi intelligence methods and techniques, as well as took advantage of a vast amount of research and data resulting from one of the most hideous projects of all times, the Nazi death camps. Other high-ranking Nazis escaped to various South American countries, assisted by American intelligence and military agencies. And these people continued to foment events conducive to their unwavering political and philosophical intentions. Now, coupled with the fact that there was no full and unconditional surrender on the part of the Third Reich, only a ceasefire agreement, one must allow for the possibility that there is more to the story than was publicly disclosed, and there usually is. Perhaps the Nazis weren't really defeated at all, but were to some extent incorporated into our government. And the activities such as the Phoenix and Montauk projects really got off the ground after their involvement. Now, there are undeniably strong indications of a substantial Nazi Aryan element in many of these endeavors, which to some extent could perhaps have filtered into our government following into World War II. Now, one conclusion that can reasonably be drawn at this point from this wealth of evidence, which is really obvious, is certain clandestine groups or agencies are conducting, continue to conduct, extremely sensitive, classified, top-secret activities in a subterranean facilities underneath Camp Hero, or maybe we should say Montauk Air Force Station, with the tacit cooperation and at times assistance of the New York State Park Systems, as well as other governmental bodies. Now, hard evidence as to what exactly these activities have been or are being conducted in the Phoenix Montauk Project, and which agencies are responsible and who the victims of this research are likely to be difficult to come by, and would take a sustained, intensive investigation by dedicated people. Certainly, one must expect the agencies and groups involved to be less than forthcoming and honest regarding any of their activities. However, incidents of threats, intimidation, abuse, and gunpointing directed against our citizens, such as those I described in yesterday's show, are quite verifiable. They're an absolute, unacceptable outrage and strongly indicate that something very nasty and extremely underhanded and secretive is still going on at the Montauk Air Force Station, especially in the subterranean laboratories and undoubtedly at other locations worldwide. Now, secret agencies of the government are operating without the knowledge or consent of any duly elected constitutional authority appear to be intent on continuing their clandestine, illegal, unconstitutional, malevolent endeavors at various locations funded by the federal government. At the very least, the areas must be clearly and unequivocally designated, fenced, posted, and patrolled. And that's what's being done outside the perimeter of Area 51 section of Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, In May of 1996, the Air Force seized over 4,000 acres from the Federal Bureau of Land Management, which was adjacent to Area 51 and top secret area known as S-4 at Nellis Air Force Base. This action was taken to prevent the public from getting too close to the very highly classified research being conducted at Area 51, involving either terrestrial or non-terrestrial aerial spacecraft displaying anti-gravity characteristics and witnessed by thousands of people previously. Of course, experiments conducted upon unknowing and hapless subjects, and most definitely the use of kidnapped children in any such experiments, have to cease immediately, and those responsible have to be brought to justice. The totally sneaky and underhanded way that Camp Hero is being administered currently is enough to indicate that very unpleasant, malicious things are still occurring. Unlike the situation at Nellis, at Montauk, they don't even want you to know there's something you're not supposed to know. In 1968, Ronald Siegel published a professional paper titled A Device for Chronically Controlled Visual Input. Now, that's the description of a device he developed to project images directly into the brain of experimental animals via the optic nerve. Now, he explained that further experimentation needed to be conducted on kittens that have their total visual stimulation controlled from the time they open their eyes. Now, if they'd consider doing this to helpless kittens, what would they do to us if they had the opportunity? 3 years later, a team of U.S. scientists wired a computer to a cat's brain and created videos of what the cat was seeing. One of the scientists working on the project, Garrett Stanley of Harvard, predicted machines with brain interfaces. We can only imagine how far such technology has advanced in the secret research laboratories of the U.S. government and the military-industrial complex. Like Matthews, today's victims can point to a wealth of documentation confirming how governmental agencies and research centers have been developing technologies and methods with the same capabilities that people have been describing for over 200 years. These technologies involve elements of psychology, hypnosis, political conspiracy, and even devices that emit rays to control the behavior of others without their knowledge or consent. In 1996, the U.S. Air Force Scientific Advisory Board published a 14-volume study of future developments in weapons called New World Vistas. Tucked away in the volume on page 89 of a 15th volume are some hair-raising insights into the future coupling of man and machine in a section dealing with biological process control. The author refers to an explosion of knowledge in the field of neuroscience and made the statement, one can envision the development of electromagnetic energy sources, the output of which can be pulsed, shaped, and focused, that can couple with the human body in a fashion that allow one to prevent voluntary muscular movements, control emotions, and if you control emotions, you can control actions, produce sleep, transmit suggestions, interfere with both short-term and long-term memory, produce an experience set, and delete an experience set. Translating the words experience set from military jargon into plain English, this means simply they can envisage the ability to erase your memories and substitute a new fictitious set of memories. By projecting such developments into the future, the authors of New Vistas are camouflaging present-day capabilities. Similar futuristic scenario with many references to mind manipulations described in the Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War that came out of the U.S. Army War College in 1994. Now, authors Stephen Metz and James Kivett declared that behavior modification is a key component to police enforcement, and an advantage of using directed energy weapons is deniability. So you have to ask, against whom is such deniability aimed?
Well, the answer to that would be the American people.
Set in the year 2010, Metz and Kivett write of perception molding and advanced psychotechnologies to avoid irksome public protest. And that's just the beginning of the capabilities. The major obstacle, they believe, is that traditional American ethics are a major hindrance. And, sadly, old-fashioned notions of personal privacy and national sovereignty have to be changed. The future presented by Metz and Kivett sounds like a mixture of George Orwell's 1984 and the movie The Matrix. Individuals unwilling to go along with the revolutionary change are identified using comprehensive interagency integrated databases. They'll be categorized, and sophisticated computerized personality simulations will be used to develop, tailor, and focus psychological campaigns for or against these individuals. Other techniques to be used in association with these new mind weapons include morphing, the present-day ability that controls the distortion of TV images. So if you're lucky enough not to have your brain electronically scrambled or erased, the electronic news media will be manipulated especially for you, presented convincing near-life visual images through your combined TV set come internet interface. Then we have synthetic telepathy. That's a term used to describe the beaming of words, thoughts, or ideas into a person's mind by mechanical means, specifically some type of electromagnetic transmitter similar to a radio or television broadcast. Operates in the microwave frequency band. Recent years, thousands of people have come forward claiming to be victims of this frightening technology. The first officially reported scientific experiment documenting a case of synthetic telepathy can't be found in the academic literature because of the highly secretive nature of that research. 1961, Alan Frey, a freelance biophysicist and engineering psychologist, reported that a human can actually hear microwaves. This discovery was dismissed by most United States scientists as being the result of outside noise, or they called it artifact. Frey found that human subjects exposed to 1310 megahertz and 2982 megahertz microwaves at average power densities of 0.4 to 2 megawatts perceived auditory sensations described as buzzing or knocking sounds. The peak power densities were on the order of 200 to 300 microwatts, and the pulse repetition frequencies varied from 200 to 400 hertz. Frey referred to this auditory phenomenon as the radio frequency sound. Sensation occurred instantaneously at average incident power densities well below that necessary for known biological damage and appeared to originate from within or near the back of the head. Now, further testing revealed that two requirements were necessary for the subject to hear the microwave-induced sound. Good bone conduction, the ability to hear acoustic energy above kilohertz. By 1975, the introduction to a paper by A.W. Guy and others begins one of the most widely observed and accepted biological effects of low-average power electromagnetic energy is the auditory sensation evoked in man when exposed to pulse microwaves. Present-day U.S. government use of synthetic telepathy was described in the October-November 1994 issue of Nexus magazine. Directed energy weapons currently being deployed include, for example, a microwave weapon manufactured by Lockheed Sanders and used for a process known as voice synthesis, which is remote beaming of audio voices or other audible signals directly into the brain of any selected human target. Process is known within the federal government as synthetic telepathy. Miniaturized telemetrics have been part of an ongoing project by the military and various intelligence agencies to test the effectiveness of tracking soldiers on the battlefield. The miniature implantable telemetric device was declassified long ago. According to Dr. Carl Sanders, the developer of the Intelligence Manned Interface Biochip, we used this with military personnel in the Iraq War when they were actually tracked using this particular type of device. It's interesting to note that the Carlspan Advanced Technology Center in Buffalo, New York, where McVeigh worked, that's Timothy McVeigh, don't you know, is engaged in microscopic electronic engineering of the kind applicable to telemetrics. Carlspan was founded in 1946 as Cornell Aeronautical Laboratory, which included the Fund for the Study of Human Ecology, and that was a CIA financing conduit for mind control experiments by immigrant Nazi scientists and others under the direction of CIA doctors Stanley Gottlieb, Ewan Cameron, and it was John West. According to mind control researcher Alex Constantine, Carlspan places a lot of research emphasis on bioengineering and artificial intelligence. In fact, they pioneered the field in the 50s. In an article he did called Good Soldier, Constantine wrote, human tracking and monitoring technology are well within Carlspan's sphere of pursuits. The company is instrumental in REDCap, an Air Force electronic warfare system that winds through every Department of Defense facility in the country. Pentagon release explains that Red Cap is used to evaluate the effectiveness of electronic combat hardware, techniques, tactics, and concepts. That system includes closed-loop radar and data links and RF man data fusion and weapons control post. One Patriot computer news board reported that a disembodied rumbling low-frequency hum has been heard across the country the week of the Oklahoma City bombing. Past hums in Taos, New Mexico, Eugene and Medford, Oregon, Timmins, Ontario, and Bristol, England, were almost definitely, despite serious official denials, attuned to the brain's auditory pathways. The Air Force is among Carl Spann's leading clients, and Elgin Air Force Base has farmed key personnel in the country, in the company. The grating irony requiring McVeigh's contention he'd been implanted with a telemetry chip is that the instrumentation technology branch at Eglin Air Force Base is currently engaged in the tracking of mammals with sub-miniature telemetry devices. According to an Air Force press release, a telemetry chip transmits on the upper S-band with up to 120 digital channels. And now we're going to talk about cyclotronic weapons research. Now, one man's name has become synonymous with the field of non-lethal weapons development. That's Colonel John Alexander. He first became known to the public through his December 1980 Military Review article titled The New Mental Battlefield. And this article clearly described the lethal nature of many of the so-called non-lethal weapons now being developed to control civilian populations. According to Alexander, psychotronics may be described as the interaction of mind and matter. Possibility for employment as weaponry has been explored. Be more specific, there are weapon systems that operate on the power of the mind and whose lethal capacity has already been demonstrated. Describing Soviet development of psychotronic weapons, Alexander stated the ability to cause death can be transmitted over distances, thus inducing illness or death for no apparent reason. If you look at the writings on Alternative 3, there were a number of deaths laid at the doorway of at the door of this Soviet program. He said these weapons would be able to induce illness or death at little or no risk to the operator. Psychotronic weapon would be silent and difficult to detect. Powerful elite insiders have long known how electromagnetic weapons can be effectively utilized to wage mind control against the population, specifically targeting political dissidents and troublemakers. So what of the numerous political activists and investigative journalists who died under mysterious circumstances? Many from rare forms of cancer. Maybe this is an explanation. Could they have been taken out by psychotronic weapons? We don't really know how advanced this technology is today. President Lyndon Johnson's scientific advisor, Dr. Gordon MacDonald, wrote the 1968 book, Unless Peace Comes, A Scientific Forecast of New Weapons. He described how man-made changes to the electrical Earth ionosphere can be used for mass behavior control. He said that low-frequency electromagnetic oscillations can attack the low-frequency electromagnetic brainwaves in human beings. He was very clear. Perturbation of the environment by geophysical warfare can produce changes in behavioral patterns. In his 1970 book, Between Two Ages, Zbigniew Brzezinski, a longtime establishment strategist, described weather control as a new weapon. That's a key element of strategy. And he was very clear, technology will make available to leaders of modern nations a variety of techniques for conducting secret warfare, which only a bare minimum of the security forces need to be apprised. He predicted the exact types of electromagnetic psychotronic weapons the U.S. administration is now developing for mass behavior control of its citizens. He said it's possible and tempting to exploit, for strategic political purposes, the fruits of research on the brain and on human behavior. Accurately timed, artificially excited electronic strokes could lead to a pattern of oscillations that produce relatively high-powered levels over certain regions of the Earth. In this way, one could develop a system that would seriously impair the brain performance of a very large population in selected regions over an extended period of time. Well, we need to say at this point that none of this information I've been giving you is meant to imply that all members of the U.S. military high command and intelligence service directors and operatives are responsible for or involved in the projects that I've talked about. Nor is it meant to imply that the U.S. government has no right to conduct legitimate defense-related research and experimentation in a great many different fields. Now, what I've been talking about falls far outside any legitimate bounds and are operated by agencies unaccountable in any way to duly elected legislative or executive authorities in blatant and wholesale disregard for the U.S. Constitution. So what that does is put us in a very interesting position. Now, of course, it also raises other possibilities. If these weapons, which started being developed in the 50s, have the impact that has been discussed, it could explain quite a number of heretofore mysterious happenings. For example, the disappearance of the USS Scorpion. We still have no idea what happened. The USS Scorpion was a one of the most powerful weapons ever launched. And in June of 1960, it completed its sea trials. It was the Navy's newest atomic-powered submarine at the time. And it took its place among America's team of leaders in the Cold War nuclear race with the Russians. And on March 3rd, 1961, it was praised publicly in a wire service story that began with Senator Claiborne Pell said yesterday, no ship anywhere in the world with the potential of the nuclear-powered submarines of the U.S. Navy. He made that observation after a seven-hour cruise on board the USS Scorpion. When asked his impression of that ship, he said, from the viewpoint of being a deterrent, there's no ship anywhere in the world that has anywhere near the effectiveness. Now, in fact, America's nuclear submarine fleet was in many ways the darling of Cold War defenses. There was something romantic about the life of a submariner with their run silent, run deep philosophy. And far from the conflict of Vietnam, they were seen by many as the nation's protectors and the beneficiaries of some interesting perks. The journal Tahoe News Service made mention of the fact that members of the crew of one of the Navy's submarines, the Scorpion, would soon have plenty of playing cards to while away the hours. This was assured Wednesday when the Tahoe Douglas Chamber of Commerce arranged with Nevada's South Shore casinos to donate cards used in the gaming rooms to the submarine. Now, on February 15, 1968, the Scorpion left Norfolk for a three-month Mediterranean tour. Now, the crew, of course, was thrilled, as the region featured some of the great beauty spots of the world. And the men could look forward to liberties among the Italian and Sicilian coast. Upon arrival at the destination, the submarine participated in exercises with NATO and the U.S. 6th Fleet. Now, as the crew pulled away for their new assignment, there was one man who wasn't overly thrilled. In fact, he was thankful he wasn't going with her. It was an electrician's mate by the name of Dan Rogers who had risked his career by demanding to be transferred off the boat. He wrote to his captain that everybody on board was in danger. Now, the Navy had always portrayed this 252-foot-long submarine as a gleaming showpiece. But Rogers said the Scorpion was so overdue for a thorough overhaul that the crew had to be calling her the USS Scrap Iron. There were oil leaks in the hydraulic system, seawater seeping in through pellet shaft seals, emergency ballast systems weren't working, and the Navy restricted her depth to 300 feet. That's one-third the operational depth of other boats of her class. And 3 months before he left the ship, the Scorpion had vibrated so violently doing high-speed maneuvers she seemed to corkscrew through the water. Now, the cause of this was never diagnosed, but based upon some of the discussions about some of the projects that were being researched at Montauk, certainly And the Russians were doing the same projects. Certainly there was cause for alarm. Now, the bulk of the work on Scorpion had been postponed due to budget cuts and the pace of intelligence operations that are growing rapidly toward a peak never before seen during the Cold War. As she left her home port, she was one of only four of the Atlantic Fleet submarines that were still waiting to be refitted with safety features. Now, that tour was largely uneventful, and the crew headed home May 17th. Sub's commander, Francis Slattery, radioed in on May 22nd, informed Atlantic Submarine Force Headquarters that arrived in Norfolk at 1 p.m. on Monday, May 28th, just in time to spend at least part of the Memorial Day with their families. And that was the last confirmed transmission from the submarine. They absolutely had no idea what happened to it after that. In late May, the families of the Scorpion's crew were informed of their anticipated arrival time, and they braved nasty weather to travel to the Navy base and take up their post along the coastline. Many armed with binoculars, trained on the sea and looking for the first signs of the sub's arrival. Well, they got there in time and waited on the 28th. They made small talk and tried to calm their jittery nerves with some small jokes. But as time passed with no sign of the submarine, questions began to be asked. Finding the first news that the Scorpion's disappearance broke when the Associated Press announced the Navy reported the nuclear submarine USS Scorpion overdue in the Atlantic Monday night with 99 men on board. The weather was described as bad. Submarines were returning from what was described as an extended training operation in the Mediterranean. That $40 million vessel should have reported in about midday as it approached Norfolk, but no message was received. Last radio contact with the submarine came in a routine message stating her position, speed, and course on May 21st. Pentagon said it's normal for a submarine making a submerged passage to observe radio silence for extended periods. Admiral Mora, Chief of Naval Operations, told newsmen at a hurriedly called news conference the Scorpion was now a few miles south of the Azores at the time of the last communique. According to Mora, the submarine would have been nearer the U.S. at the time it encountered difficulty. And he admitted at the time what happened to the Scorpion was a complete mystery. From the very beginning, search efforts seemed to be doomed to failure. One thing that happened by the weather. Submarine Shark, dispatched as part of the search, reported surface waves of 15 to 22 feet. At this point, Moore just suggested the Scorpion may have chosen to ride out severe weather by remaining submerged. He also suggested that in bad weather, a message informing Norfolk the Scorpion was being delayed could have been lost. He also acknowledged that the submarine could have attempted to contact shore in the event of a delay. If its radio communication failed, the Scorpion would have sent other signals. And so far, he said, we have not received any emergency messages. Of course, regardless of the official position, the Navy wasted no time or energy sending out forces to search for the lost craft. Concerned not just for the 99 men on board, but for the nuclear secrets the submarine carried. Associated Press provided details about the search party. Six destroyers, two submarines, patrol aircraft would have been thrown into a broad search for the vessel. Primary search zone at this point is the Atlantic area adjacent to Norfolk and extending along a 2,100-mile stretch covering the track the Scorpion would have followed from its last transmission. Now, at that point, the Atlantic ranges to 3,000 fathoms deep at some points along the Scorpion's route home. But she would have had to pass over Mid-Ocean Ridge only 1,000 fathoms at one point. Within about 55 miles of Norfolk, the Scorpion probably would have been approaching to surface at the edge of the continental shelf, which is generally about 600 feet deep at its lowest point. Moore said that the sub would disable in shallow water, its crewmen would have come up one by one. Resting on the continental shelf, a rescue bell would be lowered and affixed to the submarine to retrieve the men. But he did say that at points beyond the continental shelf, the Navy had no means of rescuing the men on board the ship. And he wouldn't discuss whether the Scorpion carried nuclear weapons. Now, the Soviets were never remiss in trying out their non-traditional weapons. And if they were used on the Scorpion, who knows what could have happened. Now, by Tuesday afternoon, May 30th, the entire nation was aware there was a problem with the Scorpion. Well, honestly, the Associated Press offered up some troubling details. The Navy reported that an oil slick was spotted along the return course of the missing submarine Scorpion 2 days after the atomic sub's last known communication. Now, that submarine and its 99 crewmen would have reported in Norfolk, Virginia at the end of a submerged Atlantic crossing on Monday, which would be May 29th. Search ships have been ordered to the oil slick area to look for any possible evidence, such as debris. But one Navy captain in charge of the massive Atlantic search effort from the Pentagon cautioned, "We attach at this time no importance whatsoever to that sighting." Captain John David told newsmen oil slicks are a routine sighting at sea. Nevertheless, he did acknowledge with the passage of time we're more apprehensive as to what the possibilities might be. At the same time, the article mentioned what had been done thus far to find the missing ship. He said when the Scorpion failed to appear, the Navy asked all ships in the Atlantic to check their records for any sightings or contacts with the Scorpion since she was last heard of about midnight, May 21st. The USS Monrovia, an attack transport, did have a report to make. Quartermaster of the Monrovia, reviewing his log, found he'd noted at 12:55 Greenwich time, 8:55 in the morning Washington time, on May 23rd, that the ship had passed an oil slick. This is about 1,200 to 1,400 miles, almost due east of Norfolk, the Scorpion's home base. And in that area, the Atlantic area ranging to 9,000 feet deep, far below the level which the Navy could hope to rescue men from a disabled sub. Sub failed to appear, and a broad search was launched with at least 36 ship planes and nearly 8,000 men. Navy men emphasized the search remained in the organizational phase at mid-morning with assigned ships and submarines proceeding to the search area along 600-foot depths, marking the beginning of the Atlantic's continental shelf about 55 miles off of Norfolk. So, was a weapon of some sort used to sink the Scorpion? We have never had an answer to that question. Well, at this point in time, we have come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.